Welcome, everyone, to the first and likely last Captain America Winter Soldier cast.
The reason we got this together is because two of us have strong feelings about angsty bisexual Steve Rogers and his many not quite canonical love affairs. And one of us has very little familiarity with this source material, but likes seeing us talk about it. I am Brendan Adkins. I'm recording in Portland, Oregon.
I'm Sumana Hariharishwara. I'm recording in New York City.
And I'm Rachel Chalmers. I'm recording in San Francisco.
So I will say that I am the person who basically said, possibly while drunk, hey, Brendan and Rachel. Like, I think I tapped it out with one hand, like, on a keyboard, because the other one was holding an alcoholic beverage, and I did not want to put it down. And I was
like, that explains it. You were a little more terse than usual.
And I used you. I used the single letter U. I was like, Brendan and Rachel, you should do a Captain America podcast.
God, like, totally.
So you've been wondering, like, I thought you might think it was fishing.
I'm actually holding a tumbler full of amber liquid and ice cubes and a lime right now, but it's ginger ale, I'm sorry to say.
Wait, am I the only one who doesn't have a beverage? I have, like, I just got off a plane, like, less than an hour ago, so I might not quite have two water bottle. I think that's all you.
You need to rehydrate. You've been on a plane.
I was on any plane. Okay. When I suggested this, we then discussed whether or not I should, if I was going to be part of this, actually watch any of the relevant source material, because the only Marvel-related things I've watched recently were that I watched Iron Man, you know, 10 years ago or whatever it is that it came out, and that's it. I haven't watched any of the Captain America stuff. I didn't watch the Avengers. Haven't seen Thor. I keep hearing people want there to be a Black Widow movie, but I'm not really clear on whether there is one. So then Rachel said, well, you should read this one fic. But it's kind of long. If I had a nonstop flight today, I would have finished it. But it was like, oh, you can't use the thing during the takeoff and the landing. So, like, I'm not quite done yet with your blue-eyed boys, which is more than 100,000 words and is on AO3. But I'm nearly done. So I've gotten to, like, a tremendous amount of the hurt and the comfort in the hurt comfort fic that Rachel so desperately craves.
It really is the apotheosis of the hurt comfort fic. It's hard to imagine anything ever topping it. Particularly as the small epilogue fragments that Fed has been posting to AO3 now themselves total over 100,000 words. So the entire thing is approaching War and Peace in epic scope.
That's amazing.
But I wanted to just, I figured I might kick things off, because this is probably going to be quite scattered and silly anyway. But I might just sort of kick this off by saying what I noticed by reading this thing, having, again, never watched any of the movies.
You haven't even seen the bit from the Avengers trailer where Steve has wood? Not even that?
No.
Okay.
One is that it seems to me like it was a really uncomfortable thing to be reading a post-torture for comfort fic today.
Yeah.
That's one.
a patriotic one at that.
Yeah. Another is, even though I have never actually watched any of the Marvel movies, I am aware of the Civil War thing in the Marvel Universe where Tony Stark is like super assimilationist and Captain America's like, fuck no, liberty, government can't track you down. And the fact that they're just like slinging barbs but totally working together on this, I'm like, wait, is this in the Civil War? Is that a thing? Like, because this is partly about like being complicit in state violence and like, hold on, like, what is, what is the, like, does civil war and like, you know, government and privacy and stuff like that come into this at all?
Okay, Brendan, let
in the
me
future, go for it.
I've got it. I'm going to totally duck and weave around the civil war question because it's become apparent to me with the leaking out of details from the MCU and its plans for Age of Ultron and the next Captain America movie, that my fandom is not, in fact, MCU. It is your blue-eyed boys. It is the fanfic itself. And my fondness for Captain America the Winter Soldier is, in fact, is an artifact of this other fandom. That said, Brendan, you're wrong to say that Steve's angsty bisexuality is not canon because it's right there in the title. Captain America, colon, the Winter Soldier. You know, that's the love affair right there.
And oh, okay.
It's actually way more complicated than just Steve and Bucky. Picking up on this idea of patriotism and complicity in state violence, I think that's actually exactly what the movie's about. It's what the Russos tried to talk about, you know, to the extent that they could within the confines of a superhero blockbuster.
Wait, is it what Rousseau, is what Jean-Jacques Rousseau was trying to talk about?
No, the film is directed by the Russo brothers, who got their start making indie films, and then they did a bunch of episodes for Arrested Development and for Community. They actually did my favorite episode of Community, which is A Fistful of Paintballs. Another argument about how the Winter Soldier, the movie, belongs in a new genre that's examining toxic masculinity and surrounding white men with black people and women and making their success or failure predicated on the extent to which they can work in a diverse team. But let's talk about that later. The point I wanted to make about patriotism is that the title, The Winter Soldier, the name for Bucky's sort of anti-hero villain character, comes from the end of the Vietnam War, when a bunch of returning veterans put together a commission to investigate American war crimes in Vietnam. And they called themselves the Winter Soldiers, and they called it the Winter Soldier Investigation.
And you know what they were naming that after, right?
Right. It comes from, I want to say, Thomas Paine's...
Good job.
Sorry?
I was saying good job, given that I'm the American and you're the Australian and you are Vince. Yeah, exactly.
So I have this even more complicated relationship with American militarism even than Native Americans. But
right, the summer soldier and the sunshine patriot.
The Winter Soldier is the patriot when things are bad. The Winter Soldier is the patriot that can interrogate the state itself, that behaves as the state's conscience. And so Bucky is nominally the Winter Soldier. It's actually just a cute name that they gave him because he was Russian. But in fact, I want to argue that Steve Rogers is the Winter Soldier in the strict sense of being the patriot who's questioning the powers that be and saying this isn't freedom, this is fear. And so in a sense, reading Your Blue-Eyed Boys today is appropriate because one of the things the movie and the fandom call on us to do is to be Winter Soldiers and is to question, you know, Bush and Cheney when they're telling us that torture is the only way to get reliable intelligence, because we know that that's not true. And it is, in fact, a pretty moral call to arms to be intelligent warriors for a moral state, for an ethical state.
Given that, the justifications for torture and the kind of backstory that I'm inferring from your blue-eyed boys
and drone warfare, which is a major element both of the movie and of current politics.
Does Stark make drones?
Yes. Yeah, Stark is in some ways a drone.
Okay. All right. That's good to sort of file away the next time that I am amused by Starky antics. I wanted to make another connection here, which is that in your blue-eyed boys, there's so much that it's intensely about the nurturing relationship between Rogers and Barnes, between Steve and Bucky, which is one where one of the primary things that Steve has to get over is he's trying to operate on a model of being being really, really careful of Barnes's autonomy and sort of like refusing to interfere with his decisions and so on and so on. But as far as I can tell, one of the big breakthroughs comes when he actually drops the premise of like respecting Bucky's independence and instead pursues a course of interdependence. And it's like, I need you, and I think you need me. And it actually pursues that. That's what leads to this breakthrough. And this leads me, maybe that's on my mind, because Brendan just turned me on to this amazing article called, I think, Mothering versus Contract by Penny Held. And Brendan, maybe you want to speak a little to A, that article, and B, whether I'm completely screwed up on seeing that connection here.
I haven't actually finished Your Blue-Eyed Boy. I'm a giant poser in this conversation, so I can't speak to whether you're bringing that to the text or not. Certainly, I think it's valid either way. The article, Mothering versus Contract, is something my friend Monica recommended to me. It's from 1987 or 1990, and it's this really strongly argued and beautifully written essay about taking a look at the economic model, the self-reliance model of everybody is a neutral actor who willingly enters into contracts with one another, and that's how the economy works. And that's how ethics and law should work. And just kind of completely disassembles it and says, no, that's not how most people most of the time act. Most of us are in relationships where we're being nurtured or nurturing. And that is often not a voluntary relationship, and it's not something you enter into as a spherical cow. It's you don't get these choices. You have to model relationships that that you did not consent to, but are obligated to and are bound to regardless. So how did you relate that to Stephen Bucky?
My thinking is that I think that coming into the fic anyway, and I realize this is a bit unfair because you haven't finished it. I haven't finished it. Probably didn't wait till you wrote it.
I wish I'd written it.
Coming into it,
fanfic for the fanfic as we speak. No way.
Coming into it, I think Rogers is. His fundamental approach to how he should treat Bucky is one of respecting his autonomy and independence in also a contractual fashion. And then I think key breakthroughs appear when he sort of nurturing role that it does reduce basically there's really touchy consent-y issues. Which I think is maybe that's the key sort of live wire in Hurt Comfort as a whole, is that in order to be comforted, the person who is hurt, it not only do they need the comfort, but they also need to get to a state of trust where the other person can comfort them without the person who needs comfort needing to explicitly ask for it.
Yeah, it's kind of the model of that fic, which I'm not deeply familiar with, but I have a little breadth of experience having read it. It's about kind of subverting the meaning of surrender, right? Like you refused to surrender before, but now you are to this pressure of care, of attention and love in some way. And that's the only way you get to heal.
Rachel, what do you think?
Yeah, it's such an interesting angle because it's almost... It kind of speaks to what we're all bringing to the text. I mean, just backing up a little bit, I know the scene that you're talking about, Simona. There's another really important scene at the end of part one, but the scene that really got lodged in my brain and made me obsessed with the fic and made me read it over and over again is actually even earlier than that. It's one of the early scenes where Bucky runs. It's all too overwhelming, and he leaves the apartment and just goes and cannot stand to be in the same room as Rogers, even though being with Rogers isn't bad. And the reason that really stung me is because I've got this years-long narrative about how I never see myself in fiction, and reading that particular scene was seeing myself, age 20, running out of a room in which nothing was particularly wrong, but I couldn't be there anymore, and I had to move, and I had to get away. And it was trying to unpack that moment of identification that led me to spend my entire summer thinking about this fic and thinking about the Winter Soldier and reading a whole bunch of related texts and basically putting up a crazy wall inside my own head with red thread connecting all of the photos. And to me...
Have you been dreaming, by the way, about it?
Yes. Yes, I have. And to me, this issue of agency is really fundamental. This idea that Barnes was traumatized specifically by being taken up into this institution and then lied to. You know, the sense in which Barnes is the Winter Soldier in the patriotic sense comes from a scene in the movie where Alexander Pierce, secret bad guy, is saying to him, your work has shaped the century. You've saved millions of lives by doing the assassinations that you do, and we need you to do it once more. And the reason he's framing the request in that way, even though it's completely ineffective at that moment, but it's very clear that Hydra managed to use Barnes by speaking to all that was good in him, his protectiveness and the fact that he was this fantastic soldier and sniper, and that's how they made him into this assassin, that they could only keep him working at that by maintaining this idea that the work that he was doing was meaningful and good. That idea that someone could be that profoundly gaslit by the institutions around them is actually what resonated with me, and it made me go back and look at growing up in Australia in a bunch of institutions that were ostensibly very nurturing, the Anglican Church and then Sydney University, and sort of looking back on those experiences from 20 years and going, wow, that was incredibly rapey, and the people who were around me were trying to take my intelligence and shape it for their own ends and use it for their own purposes. And it's taken me this long to sort of get rid of all of that damage. And so when you talk about those interactions of Steve backing off and trying not to affect Bucky's decisions and trying not to manipulate Bucky and trying not to pressure him because he's horribly conscious that he and Alexander Pierce look very similar. The young Robert Redford was actually kind of a ringer for Chris Evans. And he doesn't want to take that place in Bucky's life. He needs Bucky to have enough autonomy and enough personhood to make the decision freely. So the consent can't actually happen until Bucky has recovered to the point where his choice is meaningful.
In fact, when Bucky actually does make a pass, I mean, it's his choice.
It is.
It's clear that it's, and in fact, I all the way through part one, I was like, I guess I assumed this was Flash, but maybe it's not, because nothing's happening. And so then, right. It's just part two. I really appreciated the attention to, like, yes, I think if Steve Rogers is this paladin, you know, of lawful good, then of course, yes, like, if he had had a romantic relationship with somebody who then was completely broken, of course, not only would he not pursue it, he wouldn't even think about it, and it would have metalized it in that way.
Yeah, I actually don't think Steve is lawful good. This is something that everyone says about him. But I think young, skinny Steve growing up in Brooklyn, getting into all of those fights, I think he was a commie. I think he was better than dead. And he's still kind of a shitster. I mean...
Okay, so I think that, like, when people... this is where I get, like, utterly, utterly pedantic. I will say that I've always conceived of the phrase lawful good, not meaning necessarily that you follow the laws of the land that you are currently in so much as you have a moral code that you adhere to. And you
I'll pay that, but Rogers, yeah, I think he would love to obey orders if the orders that he was given weren't so clearly wrong and unethical. I think he's very frustrated with his chain of command. He'd love to be in a hierarchy that he didn't have to keep overthrowing, but it is what it is.
Francis Hokett and I were talking about damn it driven activism recently, which is like, well, damn it, someone's got to do this, and I'm here, so I think I got to do it now.
And this is pretty much exactly Steve, and this is why I find myself, you know, completely astonished to have this almost unironic, you know, white male guy wearing the American flag actually, you know, having an ethical meaning in my life, because, you know, growing up as a leftist Australian, American military power was, you know, the biggest threat to life on Earth. I mean, quite literally, I'm a Cold War baby. I assumed I was going to die in a nuclear holocaust sometime in the 90s. I'm still surprised that I didn't. And so to have got to the point where, and you know, Captain America's origins are actually really interesting. He's a little bit like Superman in that he was written originally in the comics by Jewish writers as a way of trying to make the case for America coming into the war. And so there's this whole larger than the law aspect to Rogers canonically, which is about him embodying the ideals of what America could be and should be. And the fact that he was this little Irish scrapper in Brooklyn is a part of that. He's responding to the Statue of Liberty. He's one of the people like me who come here because the idea is still stronger than all of the disappointments of the militaristic state that actually exists here.
I was wondering especially if we could talk a little about Captain America versus Superman, because Superman is the mythos that I am, like, orders of magnitude more familiar with. I just happened to rewatch on the plane, mostly to drown out a really loud conversation next to me, but also it's a good vid, a vid to the ELO song Mr. Blue Sky. Man, it's across lots and lots of media, so it includes the Lois and Clark TV show and the old movies and the most recent movie and some of the cartoons and so on. And some of the themes that it touched on were like Superman as just a source of awe and wonder, because, okay, here is someone who can lift incredibly heavy things and who, you know, soars through the sky. And, you know, you sort of bask in that particular feeling of, you know, it's like watching the ocean, you know, the sense of awe you get, because it's not really about a person in that sense. And the relationship of the public to Superman in the world of Superman is one of sort of like yearning, and he's like the loved one. He's like the Krishna to our Radha or something. and if you could help me understand ways in which Captain, like, how should I be approaching Captain America? Like, what does he mean as opposed to what Superman means, for instance?
Brendan, you want me to take this one as well? I feel like I'm talking a lot.
You should go for it if you've got things to say.
I would say that Superman is very much a Christ figure. He you know, is sent from outer space, and he comes down and he saves us from the worst in ourselves. I would say that Steve, by contrast, is almost explicitly a King Arthur figure. He's the once and future king. And he's also King Arthur in the sense that, you know, there's this tragic love triangle. Peggy is the lost love. And he's very human. You know, he's a sexual person. He's embedded in the world. He, you know, and whenever I think about Arthur, I think about T.H. White and Wonderful Future King, the series of novels, in which White, who himself was gay, interestingly, frames the Arthurian story very much as the struggle of might versus right, which is exactly what we're talking about with Steve as well, this idea of a lawful good paladin who serves a higher law. He's someone who's very human and very flawed and very vulnerable, but is groping towards the truth, whereas I feel really sort of remote from Superman, because I feel like there's no way in, there's no personness there. Whereas Steve is all freaking personality.
I think that because Superman had a lot of different incarnations in comics, in TV, in movies, and so on, I feel as though I have, like, an in with Superman. Like, I grew up a little bit on Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
Same.
And, oh, you did too. And so, Brendan, do you always get the sense that, like, Dean Cain as Superman, which is kind of smug and boring, but Dean Cain as Clark Kent was, like, really funny and likable.
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so.
Is that deliberate, maybe?
Well, I mean, the show is called Lois and Clark. And I think, yeah, to some degree that was done deliberately. I don't know if it was an intention on the part of his performance that grew into kind of series canon, or if that was something they did from the start. But yeah, Superman is very much
a workplace comedy.
Yeah.
About working at a, like, Clark
a romantic
Kent
comedy
works
at
for
that.
A private enterprise, you know, and Clark Kent and Superman, there's this distinction of, like, the public self and the private self, and there's this secret, where Steve Rogers, at least, I mean, is there any secret there, or is it just Steve Rogers is Captain America and everyone knows it?
Steve Rogers is Captain America and everyone knows it, but I think in this film, and, you know, based on a bunch of hints from the future of the MCU, the tension that's going to come into play is Captain America synonymous with Steve Rogers? I mean, you know, spoilers, we know he isn't, because we know other people take the costume and take the shield. And in fact, two of the co-stars in Captain America do themselves in the comics eventually serve as Captain America.
And the first, at least in the comics, the first Captain America was not Steve Rogers.
That is true. The first Captain America was African American.
Which is also a sort of government employee. I mean, the Postmaster General has not always been the Postmaster General.
Exactly. So Captain America is a role that Steve Rogers is playing. And the tension between Steve and the role is part of what you see, you know, Nick Fury playing on when he's like, you know, you better toe the line in the movie. And Steve is, you know, uneasy as the head that stands behind the shield. It's he has to make choices as Steve that are sometimes in conflict with the choices that he's expected to make as Captain America. And Bucky is really the catalyst for all of this. When he discovers that Bucky is being held prisoner and that it's his friend, and that the Winter Soldier, this assassin who's been tortured low these many years, is, you know, the person closest to him other than Peggy. You know, Nick actually has to explicitly say, I didn't know about Barnes. And if he hadn't said that, I think Steve would have had to overthrow him as well. But it's finding out about Bucky and finding out that Hydra has infiltrated S.H.I.E.L.D. that makes Steve turn around and say, well, I'm taking down the whole government agency. He's the person who finds out about torture, again, going back to the relevance of this to today, and doesn't just stand by and try and make excuses or leave. He brings down the CIA and he destroys the prisons.
Brendan, I was hoping, because I think you were the first person to actively mention sex in this podcast, so I wanted to bring that back. And tell me more about the hidden slashiness or you know, the textual cues that you see in the Captain America canon.
My familiarity with the canon is mostly limited to the movies. I didn't read a lot of the comics. I had one Captain America comic growing up that I remember. And it was an interesting one. I think it was from the early 90s. And it's about what I'm sure is a very problematic depiction of Captain America and Bucky fighting this kind of supernatural man who is, in fact, who's Native American and who is handicapped and who uses hallucinogenics to become this kind of powerful raven figure who's causing chaos at construction sites because he was a construction worker and was injured on the job. And so he sees this chaos going on and he's, you know, I'm a superhero in a city. I'm going to go find out what's going on and fight this guy. And the conclusion of the story is that Steve
is the founding of OSHA.
I'm sorry.
The conclusion of the story is that Captain America goes and founds OSHA so that construction workers don't get hurt again.
No, he tears OSHA apart. Actually, he brings down the whole agency. No. He surrenders. He says, "Look, I'm not going to keep fighting you." And it's a very explicitly in the comic. It says he kneels, which is. Maybe has informed my perspective on the sexuality of Steve Rogers from a very early age. But yeah, in terms of the movie, I guess it's just a lot about Chris Evans' performance for me, and his chemistry with the two, with Bucky and with Sam Falcon. There's a certain warmth and connection there that is very different from the character of his relationship with Scarlett Johansson, with Black Widow. I'm trying to think of other more on the surface markers that maybe Rachel can help me out with that are kind of crop up. There's one part where Steve, Sam talks about having lost his partner, and there's kind of this crackling, but wounded flirtation between them and their second encounter. Sorry, what were you saying?
The casting team did an unbelievable job, because in the one picture that you see of Sam and his partner Riley again is a dead ringer for Chris Evans. So there's this repeated, you know, symbolism of the blonde, blue-eyed boy who is lost or unattainable or who is corrupted or at risk. I mean, Chris Evans is one of those lovely, generous actors who looks at everyone on screen as if the sun's coming out of them. So it's hard to imagine that there's anybody who wouldn't have chemistry with. But seriously, if the powers that they didn't want us to ship them, why did they cast Sebastian Stan as Bucky when the man is just sex walking? I mean, he's so ridiculously beautiful. And the camera frames him in ways that make him both menacing and frightening, particularly when he's all in his combat gear as the Winter Soldier, but unbelievably seductive. He you know, blows things up and then walks slowly and confidently into the flames to rip the doors off things. It's again, I think part of the film's whole interrogation of masculinity, you know, the violence and the cruelty of it is toxic, and yet the physicality of it is magnetic and irresistible. And the film plays, I think, really cleverly with both of those aspects and makes it uncomfortable, the juxtaposition.
And Sebastian Stan is costumed and made up very differently between the first and the second movie. In the first movie, he's very much a kind of clean-cut, all-American soldier guy. Whereas in Winter Soldier, he's obviously been through a lot, but he has this permanent stubble. He has long, flowing hair and is wearing tighter clothes. You know, he's just kind of sexualized in a way that he wasn't necessarily in the first movie.
Yeah, he's been to Europe and he's come back wearing black leather. You know, it happens a lot.
Yeah.
From New York.
I'm thinking about the difference between, so you're talking about how in the films, on a visual and a performance level, Barnes is made available as a sexual object to the viewer. What about Steve?
I think to a far greater extent than Scarlett Johansson ever is in this film. She's treated very much as the colleague, the platonic work buddy to Steve, whereas Sebastian Stan is objectified literally in every scene, both for good and bad. I mean, they actually literally keep this character in a bank vault and call him the asset. He is treated as a human resource, a thing, by the bad guys, but also by the viewer's gaze. You know, it's impossible in that scene where he's actually being literally abused and he's got this childlike affect and Robert Redford punches him across the face. He's got his shirt off, and it's actually hard to concentrate on the gravity and emotional impact of the scene because Sebastian Stan is a ridiculously good-looking human. And that draws us into complicity. You know, that makes us also offenders in this whole long 70-year history of people just wanting to use Bucky Barnes for our own purposes and not giving him his autonomy and not giving him his agency. Which leads us to the terrible final scene on the helicarrier, which I will never recover from. Which is all about Steve dropping his shield and saying, I'm not going to fight you anymore. You do what you want to do. And he's the first person in 70 years who's given Bucky Barnes a name and B, the right to choose.
That's a very good point.
That was that was really helpful to me. And I will now, when I watch the film, I will, I'm pre-warned about the complexity that I'll be in objectifying Bucky Barnes. I wanted to also hear about the choices that the filmmakers made in, it sounds like, sexualizing Steve Rogers in a way that's quite pleasurable for a het woman like me to watch.
Oh, good Lord.
They put him in very small shirts. That's a thing that definitely happens.
Well, question, is it possible to make a shirt that would fit Chris Evans? I think, you know, he just puts on shirts and then his muscles flex and poor shirt.
I think all shirts become small in his presence.
Well, you know, Rachel, if you'd actually stuck with the Sydney Anglicans, you would have eventually come across, can God make a shirt so big?
It wasn't a case of me sticking with the Sydney Anglicans. It was a case of the Sydney Anglicans politely asking me to leave.
Oh.
Who can blame?
Oh, wow. Is that on your resume somewhere?
It should be.
I'm trying to remember. I think it's in Avengers, though, that I'm thinking of. The particular shot of Steve beating the crap out of a punching bag that really just frames his back muscles and his posterior area in a very specific way. I don't think there's like a shower scene or anything that I'm remembering.
There is a shower scene in Winter Soldier. When they wash up at Sam's place.
Oh, yeah, at Sam's apartment. Right.
He's wearing a tank top, but that's okay.
Yeah, he's not quite presented the same way that Sebastian Shaw is. He's never actually bare-chested, sweating in bondage, and being slapped across the face. But, which makes his kind of deliberate surrender and submission at the end of the movie that much more affecting.
Yes.
That sounds pretty cool.
My best friend teaches film at School of the Arts here in San Francisco, and just because I love seeing the expression on her face whenever she's around, I call The Winter Soldier the Citizen Kane of movies.
Oh, that's so great.
She actually got me back last week because we were in a comic book store and she started telling her son that Bucky Barnes was the villain. And I said, he's not a villain. And she said, yes, he's the bad guy.
No.
Almost came to fisticuffs right there in two cats in her portion. Because Bucky, and you know, I'm actually very hardline on this. I won't brook arguments. Bucky is not a villain. Bucky is an abused child. He is the child locked in the basement in Omelas.
Yeah.
He is used by the villains, but he's not complicit, I guess I'm saying.
I was wondering whether we could get through an entire podcast with you without you breaking out Omelas, Rachel.
Science shows us that this is not something that can be done.
Is this because your friend is named Salome and it's an anagram?
Oh my God. That is good.
What I lack in canon knowledge, I bring in anagrams. I was curious if either of you would like to talk a little bit about gender, not just sexuality, but also the gender stuff around, like, are there actually any het romances in any of these movies? And, like, are the women... in these movies, are the women women, or are they basically men with boobs on? If that in the sense, in the like very binary, gendery way that movies tend to portray, like strong women as basically being like men who happen to be played by women actresses.
Shout out to Kate Beaton and her strong female.
Yeah. So. Are we talking about the Marvel movie universe in general, or the Captain America movies specifically?
I want to hear about the Captain America movies, but if you want to branch out and say, but also this other movie is particularly good or bad, then I definitely want to hear about that.
Well, Peggy, and
yeah,
you know, it remains to be seen what will happen with Agent Carter, but Peggy is, you know, despite being very badass and kick-ass, explicitly coded feminine through both films. in a way that actually in this film provides a really interesting contrast to Natasha, who's very much of the man with boobs persuasion. Mm. Having said that, as a man with boobs myself, I can't even begin to express what a relief it is to see a woman on camera who's there because she's extremely competent and intelligent and hardworking and who isn't, you know, falling over herself to seduce the main character. It's a breath of fresh air.
Remind me, Rachel, did you see, I'll just interrupt briefly, Rachel, did you ever see the pilot for a TV show based on Warren Ellis's Global Frequency?
I did not, but I think Jeremy was trying to get me to watch it quite a lot. So
Michelle Forbes, who had been Ensign Roe in Star Trek The Next Generation and who was Admiral Kane in Battlestar Galactica, would have played Miranda Zero, the incredibly no-nonsense head of Global Frequency. I think it is worth you finding that pilot, which is 45 minutes of pleasure.
And, you know, while we're talking about competence porn, there's also Maria Hill, who, again, is one of Marvel's modern, incredibly kick-ass men with boob female characters, but played, you know, incredibly well in this film by Cobie Smulders. There's one scene in particular where she's at the big computer console doing stuff on the helicarrier, glances over, sees from a surveillance camera that people are coming to shoot her, pushes back from the console on her wheelie chair, shoots the intruders, and goes back up to the screen and carries on her magical hacking. It's a very nice bit for her.
That's really great. Brendan, what were you going to say? Sorry.
Oh, I may have lost it now.
We're talking about gender.
Yeah.
Our gender agenda.
I had not put it together until you brought it up, Rachel, but in the first two appearances of Black Widow in Marvel movie canon, there's always a heavy emphasis on her ability to seduce people, her ability to kick ass while looking sexy, very much the strong female character in the Kate Beaton mold. You know, she always has to grab somebody with her thighs or be vulnerable, but really getting to the bad guys. And that just doesn't happen, to my best recollection, in Winter Soldier.
She does do the side moves on Bucky in the fight on the bridge, but very much as part of her going through all of her Black Widow moves, she throws the stinger at his metal arm as well.
Yeah.
And I think, and you've both run into, I'm sure, the difficulty of, well, if there's only one or there's only two women characters in a film or in a canon, then it's annoying when any one of them is kind of a particular stereotype that we see too often. Whereas if there were like dozens, then it kind of wouldn't feel so bad. I felt this way, like when I was at hacker school, like, okay, there's, you know, dozens of women around me. So if a few of them fulfill a particular stereotype about either women or women in computing or whatever, it doesn't like set my teeth on edge and worry about like, wait, if I'm talking about hacker school, do I need to like find some way to change how I talk? No, there's lots of different kinds of women and some of us have very different, you know, gender presentations or styles or approaches, and that's fine.
And thank you. That is a perfect segue back into the point that I bookmarked earlier about this being part of a new genre of, I'll call it diversity porn because why not? Diversity competence porn, that's better. In the crucial scene in this movie where Steve has to make his decision and he decides to bring down S.H.I.E.L.D., he is in a bunker with Nick Fury, Sam Wilson, Maria Hill and Natasha Romanoff, two women and two black men. And he cannot do what he's trying to do without winning them over. In order to get to the denouement, he has to work with this team. And it's two black men and two women. So neither of them has to be... Sorry, did I just fall off?
I think you did. I lost the call entirely.
Hi, this is Simona, and I am speaking, and I hear Brendan.
Okay, can you hear Rachel as well?
Hello?
Yes, okay. You said hello, and then I heard you. Okay, great. So you were saying that because there's, you know, at least two representatives of both underrepresented ethnic and sexual groups and gender groups.
And our two glorious angsty bisexuals, Steve and Bucky.
Got it. So you're pretty sure Steve Rogers is bi?
Well, Peggy. He's to the extent that you think he and Bucky are a couple, he is actually canonically bi because it's made very clear in the canon that Peggy is his true love.
What do you think, Brendan?
Oh, yeah, I buy into that completely. The practice of queering coded characters in fan work has, I think, shifted more toward, less toward, oh, this X person is totally closeted, and more toward, you know what? There is evidence that people have a broader range of romantic and sexual interests, and I can't say I object to that.
Do we actually have any reason to believe that Bucky has any interest in women?
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Another casting choice, actually. In the very first scene of Captain America, the First Avenger, Steve gets in a fight in an alley and Bucky comes in with sexy motor walk and rescues him. He says, I've got tickets. And Steve says, where are we going? And Bucky says, to the future. And they're off to a double date at Howard Stark's expo in your neighborhood, Savannah, at that big park in Queens.
Oh, right, because it's like World's Fair type area in Queens, right? Corona Park, probably, near the giant globe. Right.
And so the point of the scene is that Bucky's date is all over Bucky because, as aforementioned, Sebastian Stan is incredibly beautiful. And Steve is skinny and pre-serum at this point, and so his date is really bored and not interested in him. But the awesome casting choice is that the girl who plays Bucky's date is, and I can't remember the actress's name, but she is now the Doctor's companion, Clara Oswald, in the current season of Doctor Who.
And the Doctor Who connection to this particular podcast is also that one reason why Brendan and Rachel wanted me to even be in on this is because I previously made a hilarious appearance on a podcast that my friends Moss and Julia made with me when the three of us were walking across England, and I had never seen an episode of Doctor Who before, but the first episode of the new Doctor Who season, or series to our British listeners, was coming out in England. So we basically recorded like 10 minutes of me saying what I knew about Doctor Who from like fandom. Then, you know, we went and watched the episode, and then we came back and recorded 45 minutes of me being like, so no one told me about the lizard woman. And
so as a very Commonwealthian kid, Doctor Who was in my life what it sounds like Superman was in each of yours. He was the embodiment of everything that was best about the society in which I was growing up, which in Australia in the 70s was still heavily, heavily influenced by Britain. And for all that he's problematic, the idea of Doctor Who, the idea that intellect and romance overcome brute force and cynicism was a really important one to me. And it's interesting to watch myself this year completely shift that allegiance away from the current seasons of Doctor Who and towards this Russo film about Captain America, because to me, Steve is hitting those lines far better than Doctor Who has in a while, and in particular, the treatment of sexuality and gender issues is, in fact, race issues is I think much better in the film than it is in Doctor Who at the moment.
The way that you've articulated what Doctor Who was to you in terms of sort of an embodiment of those values, for me personally growing up, Superman existed, but it generally felt like more of a an awe-related story about, like, you will believe a man can fly. But the story that really shaped my values and reflected back to me the values I cared about was Star Trek The Next Generation and Captain Picard in my Doctor Who.
Yes.
You know? He, and in like specifically, right, multiple times over the course of Star Trek The Next Generation, Captain Picard explicitly makes speeches about the necessity of doing things like refusing orders to do unethical things. And I think there's like a 7 or 10 minute supercut that someone has put together on YouTube, and I was just sobbing as I watched that, right? And I was like, this is my fandom.
Okay, so the wheel comes full circle. A supercut exactly like that exists in canon, in Community, in this incredibly meta episode called Paradigms of Human Memory. Because
Is that Inspector Spacetime?
I think it slightly predates Inspector Spacetime, but again, the looping. But Jeff is that white male character. He is hero protagonist, and here he is, and we're expecting about him and Britta, the good-looking white girl, and them getting together. And the whole point of Community under Dan Harmon, and season four never happened, so let's never discuss it, is, again, that Jeff has to get over himself. He has to, you know, he's always the one making big speeches about leadership, but this scene in Paradigms of Human Memory makes that absurd by juxtaposing all of these completely ridiculous assertions and making it obvious that that leadership role is just a role that he plays, and that in fact the dynamic of the group depends as much on the love between Troy and Abed and the relationship between Jeff and Shelley as it does between, you know, Jeff and all of his minions. So I think both Community and Brooklyn Nine-Nine and maybe Parks and Rec as well take that idea of a workplace comedy that's deliberately and explicitly diverse, and those relationships between people who would not otherwise have spent this much time together, but because they're all joined together for a common cause, they have to overcome their differences. Mm-hmm. I think that's enjoying a resurgence in all of these shows. It's about trying to imagine a future in which, you know, suddenly the president is not automatically assumed to be a white man.
And they're all comedies as well.
Well, I would say that The Winter Soldier is part of this as well, but it's definitely not, although it's very funny in parts, it's definitely not a comedy.
Well, does it end in a marriage? Because my understanding from playing Shakespeare...
Brendan? I'm going to say yes, but Brendan?
yeah, it could take a place off screen, certainly.
No, the river, when that riverbank moment.
I feel that would have a difficulty obtaining legal standing.
Listen to you.
There's no witness. There's explicitly no witness.
There's only the camera. Yeah. We are all witnesses.
We are the witness. Oh my god! Insert head explode gif.
I think that is probably a good place to wrap things up for the evening.
Always end on a wedding. You always end on a wedding.
That's what makes this podcast a comedy. thank you so much to both of you for talking this out with me and for bringing a lot of really, really interesting things to light.
Captain, it was my genuine pleasure.
It was really great. All right. Have a great night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Take care. Good night, everybody.